Hello and welcome to the Eastern Front. I am Yulia Zsuzsa with the Middle East Institute, Georgetown and George Washington Universities, and I'm joined by my colleagues.
Giselle Donnelly, I'm a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and
David Borohash, also with AEI.
On our podcast, we talk about the many challenges to European peace that tend to emerge along a line running from the Baltic to the Black Sea, the Eastern Front, and about why those matter to the United States. If you enjoy this episode, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing us. Today, we're joined by Özgür Ünlü Hisar Çiklin, who is the regional director of the German Marshall Fund in Turkey. Özgür, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Yulia.
Let's start off by talking broadly about where Turkey is trying to place itself in great power competition, strategic competition, whatever you want to call it. And I'll start with what is, I think, at this point, when we're looking particularly at the region of the Black Sea, the $1 million question that I think Özgür gets asked probably every other day now for many years. But nevertheless, I'm going to ask him as well to start off the conversation. And that is the relation that Turkey has with Russia in the context of the Ukraine war, particularly. It seems that Turkish foreign policy has been evolving for some years now. The war seems to have been a bit of a catalyst. Can you break down to us or give us a bit of an overview of the relationship between Turkey and Russia and about this, I guess, what I would call an uncertain dynamic, a complicated relationship?
Well, thank you for the question, Yulia. So if we consider the Turkey-Russia relationship taking the last decade as a period, then we can say that Turkey's policy has been evolving. But if we take a look at the last few centuries, which in Turkey's case one should do, you can actually see lots of continuity and consistency in the Turkey-Russia relationship. So that's where I would like to start with, because there is a historical pattern in the Turkish-Russia relationship, dating, of course, from the Ottoman and Russian empires. So this has always been a relationship that has been characterized by competitive cooperation. So Turks and Russians compete at times, and sometimes the competition may be violent, with Russia winning in the end. They can cooperate at other times, and then they can shift from competition to cooperation very quickly, and then at other periods they can compete and cooperate at the same time. So this is the historical pattern. But then if we try to understand what are the drivers of their nature, of their relationship at a particular period, we see that when both countries excluded or targeted by the West, they draw closer to each other. But when either one of them, which is usually Turkey, has a better relationship with the West, they draw apart from each other. I will give an example from a century ago, actually. So after the First World War, when there was a war of independence in Anatolia, and when the Soviet Union was recently established, both the Soviet Union and the independence movement in Anatolia felt that they were targeted by the West. So Russia became the only state ally of the revolutionary Turks, led by Kemal Atatürk in Ankara. And this relationship actually continued after the Turkish Republic was established. In 1924, the two countries signed a friendship treaty. In 1934, they renewed the treaty, but later, Russia started getting concerned that Turkey was signing similar agreements with Western European countries such as Great Britain and France. And as Turkey formed better relations with Western European countries, we saw the relationship between Turkey and Russia souring, which, I mean, fast forward, led to Turkey becoming a member of NATO. So this is the relationship. And what does Russia represent in Turkish strategic thinking? Russia is always an option for hedging for Turkey. So when Turkey feels uneasy about its relationship with its Western allies, it improves its relations with Russia. We saw this actually during the 1970s, when after the Cyprus War, Turkey was imposed an arms embargo by the United States, and also the European allies also showed negative reactions to Turkey. And this was a time when Turkey was trying to industrialize, and the United States refused assisting Turkey in its industrialization efforts. Suddenly, Moscow showed up on Turkey's doorstep and said, "We can help you." So during the 1970s, which was détente years anyway, in general. But Turkey was much more enthusiastic about détente than any of the other NATO allies. And in those years, Turkey's heavy industrial infrastructure was built by the Soviet Union, by Soviet engineers, funded through Soviet financial instruments. But this was not a problem for the United States because this was not contrary to Turkey's strategic positioning. Of course, the problem is when the Turkey-Russia relationship actually starts to contradict Turkey's treaty commitments.
I wonder if I could ask you a question about Turkey's domestic politics. You've written about the subject at numerous occasions, and it strikes me that it's fair for an outside observer to look at Turkish elections and conclude that they might not be fair, but they are still quite competitive. And most recently there was the local elections held in April where the Kemalist opposition scored significant wins, especially in big cities in Istanbul and Izmir in Ankara. Obviously the name of Erdogan is very often used in the same sentence as Viktor Orban and Vladimir Putin, which very often obfuscates the matter more than it sort of enlightens it, because there is a bit of big spectrum when it comes to incumbent entrenchment and how far these processes are going. But the opposition seems, you know, alive and vibrant. So there'll be an election in 2028, a parliamentary one. You know, is Turkey in a position in which opposition parties can jointly or individually actually have a decent chance at displacing the ruling AKP party? Or has Turkey kind of gone, you know, past the point of no return, so to speak?
Thank you. I mean, Turkey increasingly resembles a competitive authoritarian system in which the playing field is not level, but the opposition still has a chance to win elections. And in Turkey's case, this is not just theoretical, but practically proven. With the latest elections, again, the playing field was highly uneven. And actually, also the opposition's victory, I mean, the extent of their victory was surprising even for the opposition parties. But it happened. So yes, I mean, the Turkish elections are not fair. They are not 100% free either, with certain candidates being banned, certain, you know, people banned from making propaganda, etc. But they are actually highly competitive. They are not predictable. They bring surprising outcomes, which are actually signs of a healthy election system. And I must also say one thing that others need to understand about Turkish elections. Now, we Turks distrust each other. Like, you Americans are too trusting. But our system is based on the premise that somebody is going to try to rig the election. So it's really very transparent. Opposition parties are always on high alert, with people not sleeping for days, with people actually sleeping on sacks of votes so that nobody can steal them. My 80-year-old mom is still an election observer. I'm not sure she's practically useful, but she's there still. She's always been there. So I have full trust in the Turkish election system. Moreover, I think that discrediting our elections, and this is not only for Turkey, maybe particularly for the United States these days, actually discrediting our own election systems serves Russian propaganda. Because what does Putin tell us? Putin tells us we should not trust our institutions. Putin tells us we should not trust our state. Putin tells us we should not trust our democratic systems. And when we start doing what he's telling us, I think we're serving his interests. And as a matter of fact, that an incumbent is undefeatable in an election becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if you cannot defeat the incumbent in an election, why even try, right? But we're not there in Turkey. I mean, Turkey is a very vibrant society, still standing civil society. People are very much politicized. Actually, there is great enthusiasm about voting. I mean, voting turnout is around 80%. I mean, voting is like national service or even religion in Turkey. So I have full confidence in the Turkish election system.
And relatedly, it strikes me that there is another difference between Turkey and, say, Russia, which oftentimes sort of used as a point of comparison, which is that unlike Russia, Turkey does have an actual private economy. I mean, Russia is, as Mitt Romney used to say, what is it, gas station pretending to be a country, or was it McCain? It was McCain. I mean, you know, Turkey does have manufacturing, has services, has tourism, has all kinds of sort of things that sort of serve as independent centers of power, so to speak, which just are absent in a country like Russia. So that gives me some hope that trade, economic ties, regulatory barriers and those sorts of things can serve as sort of points of leverage for Western partners to sort of engage with Turkey and perhaps, you know, get course correction when it's needed. Is this the correct impression, or am I deluding myself?
I think it's a very correct impression, and I would actually go further than that. I mean, in Russia, citizens are ready to give up a lot of their liberty and actually prosperity in return for a little security, right? In Turkey, Turkish citizens are not willing to do that, and certainly when it comes to prosperity. So Turkish citizens, yes, expect their country, their government to deliver security, but they also expect the government to deliver prosperity, and also they expect the government to not meddle with their private lives. And there's a price to be paid when a government does that. I mean, two decades ago, different Turkish governments were meddling with the private lives of religious conservative Turkish citizens, and they paid actually a huge price. So basically, those parties had no impact on the Turkish society anymore for two decades. They are now recovering as the Turkish opposition parties, and they have learned their lesson, and they are respectful to individual citizens' private lives. It seems that, you know, the governing parties are now less respectful to the private lives of some of Turkey's citizens, particularly the secular ones, of course.
If we could return to security questions for a second, and in particular NATO, which is about to celebrate its 75th birthday here in Washington next month, I wonder if you could sort of give us a general assessment, both of how President Erdogan, but also Turkish elites in particular, sort of now regard the alliance, and how we Americans or outsiders should read the previous accession round, whether the Turks feel they sort of got their fair due and consideration, say, from Sweden's joining the alliance, how Turkey would feel about further alliance expansion, because it would be very much focused on Southeastern Europe and the Black Sea, you know, Turkey's backyard, so to speak. And again, just if you can forecast how you think the country might respond to NATO reemerging as the central, you know, security organ across the European continent and reaching, you know, toward the Caucasus, etc. So I know it's a long and involved question, but I would very much appreciate your take on those things.
Yeah, I mean, there are times when I try to circumvent questions, but with this one, I have very, very clear. Turkey is 100%, if not 200%, in favor of Ukraine's membership to NATO, and also Georgia's, by the way. Subsequent Turkish governments have made this very clear. This position has not changed. President Erdogan has recently announced this again, that Turkey is supportive of Ukraine NATO membership. Turkey actually had no problem in principle about Sweden and Finland becoming NATO members. Turkey had concerns about Sweden's policies towards countering terrorism, which actually Sweden itself was, you know, beginning to fix for its own security concerns, by the way. So Turkey used Sweden's NATO membership to sort those issues out. And now actually there's a very vibrant and positive relationship between Turkey and Sweden as well. And do Turks criticize NATO? Yes, I mean the Turkish elite. But when the Turkish elite criticizes NATO, they criticize it from within. Unlike, for example, when Turks criticize the European Union, they criticize it from without. And, you know, one thing that Turks realize once again with Sweden's NATO membership is that nothing happens at NATO without Turkey's vote, right? It's a unanimous voting system. So this is a unique example where Turkey has an equal standing with other Western countries in a platform, which is also politically very valuable for Turkey. But one may ask, why is Turkey so enthusiastic about Ukraine's NATO membership? Is Turkey being more kingly than the king? For its own sake, basically for its own sake, so that in the long run, Turkey can counterbalance Russia in its region more easily. So for Turkey, Ukraine is a strategic partner. This is why, for example, Turkey has set up a drone factory close to Kiev. It's not just about this war. Of course, it will play a role in this war as well, but this is a long-term relationship. While Turkey is setting up a drone factory close to Kiev, Ukraine is actually providing engines to some of Turkey's drones. We will see the Turkish and Ukrainian defense industries collaborating ever more closely in the future. Ukraine is also an important trading partner for Turkey, and the more Ukraine prospers, the better for Turkey's trade relationships. Ukraine will also is actually similar to Turkey in a way, on the peripheries of Europe, in Europe, but not part of the European Union, but not such a small actor that it doesn't matter either. So Turkey understands Ukraine. Ukraine understands Turkey. And both countries are bordering Russia, which of course is nothing small. So there is no doubt that Turkey is 100% in favor of NATO expansion, particularly when it comes to Ukraine.
If I could ask just a real quick follow-up, I'd like to drill in a little bit on the Black Sea in particular. Pacts like the Montreux Convention and so on and so forth has been an important element in Turkish security for a long time now. But the changing character of warfare at sea, and particularly in smaller enclosed seas, where we see the Ukrainians basically able to drive the Russian Black Sea fleet away from the Western Black Sea and resume their grain exports back to the pre-war level, so on and so forth. I just wonder how Turkish thinking about the future of the Black Sea is maybe changing as a result of this experience.
Let me couple a similar question here to Giselle's and also ask, because you brought up Ukraine in the context of NATO, also ask about within these geographic limits or this geographic situation, I'm wondering how Turkey or the Turkish decision makers, elites, see their desired end of the war. What is, from the Turkish perspective, the, if we can call it ideal, the desired way in which this war can and should end?
I mean, first of all, we should not think that Ankara is complacent about the Russian threat and how it would grow in case Russia ended the war on its own terms. First of all, Turkey is aware of this. And Turkey is also aware that it will have a harder time counterbalancing Russia, particularly in the Black Sea, if Russia keeps what it has already occupied. I mean, Ukraine has crippled the Russian Black Sea Navy, but once the war is over, it's a matter of a year for China to revive the Russian Black Sea fleet. We should not have any disillusions about this. But there is another aspect of the Black Sea that we should not miss. The Black Sea is not very friendly for surface vessels. I mean, Ukraine has proven it, right? Like, surface vessels are very vulnerable from all domains of warfare in the Black Sea. It's very narrow. So if Turkey is going to counterbalance Russia in the Black Sea, it will be with submarines. Now, there are three NATO allies with presence in the Black Sea: Turkey, Bulgaria, and Romania. Bulgaria and Romania don't have substantial Black Sea fleets. For now, I think they should, and we should all help them build their Black Sea submarine fleets. But for the time being, it's Turkey. The Turkish submarine fleet is substantial, and Turkey can counterbalance Russia for now. But the problem is the Turkish submarine fleet is also becoming outdated. It needs renovations. And let me take advantage of this platform to also make the point that limitations on defense sales to Turkey prevent Turkey from upgrading its submarine fleet, which is contrary to NATO's strategy in the Black Sea, and I think should be considered. Now, when it comes to Montreux, first of all, from Turkish perspective, Montreux is one of the sovereignty constituting treaties that's in addition to Lausanne that Turkey signed. And Turkey is very sensitive about its sovereignty, not very similar from the United States. So Turkey will not reconsider Montreux under any circumstance. So I think we should just keep that as a basic assumption that Turkey will continue implementing the Montreux Convention. And by the way, it's good that Turkey is like, so for example, when did Turkey block the Bosphorus using the Montreux Convention? Well, when actually Ukrainian military intelligence, probably informed by other military intelligences, informed Ankara that Russia is preparing to bring new ships from the Syrian theater to the Black Sea to put naval pressure on Odessa, and they also informed that Odessa may not be able to hold if this happens. On the same that Ukraine gave this information, Turkey blocked the Bosphorus with the authority that Montreux gives Turkey. So we should also understand that Montreux Convention is in favor of NATO, NATO's strategy. Also, I would also like to bring your attention to the fact that NATO allies are also very much concerned about being dragged into this war. Like, we're concerned about being dragged into this war when giving certain weapons to Ukraine. So what makes us think that actually NATO allies would like to send their warships into the Black Sea, which could easily lead to NATO being dragged into the war? So I think that for the future, we should build a Black Sea strategy based on the Montreux Convention being effect. And here again now, Ukraine is very critical. If Ukraine can recover Crimea, then Turkey's job will be much easier, first of all. I mean, with Crimea in Ukrainian hands, Turkey will gain a dominant position in the Black Sea. With Crimea in Russian hands, then Turkey will need a strong Ukraine, even if it has lost Crimea, with a Ukraine that has a strong Black Sea presence as an ally on board. And that's the least Turkey would expect. And I think that NATO, once this war is over, whenever it is over, we should make sure that the Ukrainian Navy is supported by NATO allies for the sake of NATO strategy in the Black Sea. And Turkey would be very much welcoming on that.
I want to ask you one thing, build on one thing that you mentioned a bit earlier, and that is in the context of NATO, you were mentioning criticism from within and criticism from without when it comes to the EU. And within this, I want to ask you about Turkey EU relations. It feels like it was a long time ago when we were talking about Turkey's EU integration and that a lot of things have happened in between. But if we are to look at the relationship between Turkey and EU, I guess in similar manners, it's dynamic, it's changing, it's complicated. What would you say from Turkey's perspectives are now the key elements, the key components of this relationship? What matters to Turkey? What does Turkey want from the EU in current circumstances? Is it just about migration, or is there more to it in sort of the political and economic dimensions?
Yulia, first of all, I think it's now okay to publicly say that Turkey's EU accession process is in the deep, deep, deep freezer for the foreseeable future. That actually the accession framework is not what will drive the EU to Turkey relationship in the future.
It's in the freezer of the basement.
I mean, as they say, this Turkey will never become a member to this European Union. And I cannot imagine another Turkey and another European Union. But having said this, Turkey does value the economic, trade and investment relationship it has with the European Union. The European Union is by far Turkey's most important export market. By even a higher margin, is the most important source of foreign direct investment to Turkey and also a source of know-how transfer. So there is no doubt about that. But Turkey is also trying to diversify that. So Turkey is also hedging on the economic domain, and Turkey is trying to identify new trading partners and investing heavily in Africa, because Africa will be the driver of global demand in the upcoming decades, and Turkey wants to take some share of that. Turkey also was targeting the Middle East, but given the turmoil the Middle East is in, it's not a very attractive market for Turkey. But Turkey is also reaching out to Central Asia and beyond, and wants to open the middle corridor also. These are important. But what is most crucial for Turkey and the European Union is the European security architecture. Because for the time being, Turkey is excluded from the European security architecture. I mean, if you look at the European compass outlining European foreign policy and security strategy, if you look at President Macron's recent speech at Sorbonne, and if you look at the speeches of other EU leaders, you see Turkey being identified as a competitor, if not rival, for now they don't use the term rival, but it's seen as a competitor of the European Union. And sometimes Turkey also takes pride in this, like we're competing with the EU. But it's not good for Turkey, it's not good for the European Union. Now, if the European Union aspires to have strategic autonomy, it should think and think again and again what it would mean to be excluding Turkey from its security architecture. I think this is the main issue. And of course, Turkey also carries some of the burden. I mean, Ankara is showing no effort in, you know, harmonizing its policies with Europe either. So it's not a one-way street. Neither Brussels nor Ankara, I think, is paying enough attention to this issue. And the thing is, some other issues like Turkey's EU accession process, customs union modernization, visa liberalization, these are great to have, but there is no real urgency, right? But when it comes to security, there is a real urgency that both Ankara and Brussels should realize. Now, Ankara has not given up on its aspirations to be part of the European security architecture and to contribute to Europe's strategic autonomy and to be part of it. But for the time being, there is no invitation to do so. And Turkey is still waiting for this invitation.
From an American point of view, European strategic autonomy doesn't look that different from American isolationism. I mean, a Europe without American participation, not to mention American leadership, would be a very uncertain prospect. You know, we have 500 years of bloodshed on the European continent as a point of reference in this way. And it does sometimes feel like both manifestations of this impulse, the sort of Trumpian America first, America by itself version and the Macron strategic autonomy paradigm, you know, from a distance look pretty similar and look pretty unappetizing. You know, I'm curious as to whether in private, Turks also sort of rue the prospect of a Europe that actually becomes more vulnerable, you know, more subject to the Franco-German way of things, and thus really skeptical of European strategic autonomy as being something that would not improve security for Turkey.
Let me second what you just said. I mean, strategy is about matching capabilities with aspirations. When it comes to European strategic autonomy, the aspiration is there, but the capabilities are not. And European allies, and this goes for Turkey as well, actually. I mean, we don't have a plan for building the capabilities that would match our aspirations. I give that to you. Now, on the other hand, for European allies, Macron might have other thinking, of course, but for most European allies, strategic autonomy is not something that they actually want to have, but they feel it's something that they might need. And I mean, there is no timeline for US reduction of troops in Europe. And there is, I think, no desire, no intent either. I don't think that Washington wants to, you know, reduce troops in Europe, but things in other parts of the planet may evolve in ways that may compel the United States to do so abruptly. I mean, the Pacific theater. So Europe wants to be ready when that happens. And from Turkey's perspective, it's no secret that for Turkey, NATO equals the United States. Okay? For Turkey, NATO is US reassurance, not US plus European reassurance. It's US reassurance. Everybody knows this. But again, I mean, Turkey is not a superpower. It does not have the power to individually impact how these things evolve. So if it comes to the United States reducing troops in Europe and the European Union having to develop its strategic autonomy, so then Turkey would rather be part of it rather than being excluded. So it's not Turkey's desire that this happens. But if it is going to happen, Turkey would rather be part of it.
So, Özgür, we have to let you go soon, but you've given us a perspective on relations, Turkey looking north and Turkey looking west in detail. And we can't let you go without asking you about Turkey looking east. We have the foreign minister of Turkey, Hakan Fidan, now on a visit to China. It's the highest level bilateral visit in over a decade. And the relationship between China and Turkey is also complicated with many aspects from Uyghur minorities to economic relations, etc. And of course, the context of that as well is Turkey's very high inflation and the fact that Turkey has been, and correct me if I'm wrong, over the past decade or more, trying to court China to increase economic cooperation and maybe also exports of Turkey to China. So when you're looking at the relationship between the two, and maybe also tell me if I'm wrong, some pressure from the United States when it comes to China across the European continent, we feel it. I'm guessing Turkey is feeling it too. How do you understand this bilateral relationship and what is Turkey trying to get from China in the coming years?
I mean, first of all, I think this is another area where the outcome is very different from the aspirations. Like all other countries, Turkey also wants Chinese investments. Turkey wants to be able to invest in China, by the way. Also, Turkey wants part of the Chinese market, proportional, of course, with its economy. And Turkey would like to be on the connectivity infrastructure built by China. None of this is happening. I mean, China is not investing in it. They are investing in Turkey as they're investing everywhere. But compared to some other European countries, the Chinese investment in Turkey is really not so high. And then Turkish companies have been utterly unsuccessful in investing in China. Turkish companies have a negligible market share in China. And even more significantly, China hasn't included Turkey in its connectivity infrastructure. I mean, for example, in their Maritime Silk Road project, they chose Greece and Egypt as their partners. One on Turkey's east, one on Turkey's west, but not Turkey. So like they invested in the Piraeus port and the Alexandria polyport, but not in Turkey. And some of the projects that Turkey is developing are actually contrary to Chinese strategy. But Turkey, of course, continues to aspire because Turkey wants to diversify its economic relationships and doesn't really make choices. Like Turkey wants to reach out to any market it can reach out to. And also interesting, like Turkey wants to be associated to all regional groupings it can be associated with, even if it's very far away from that region. This is part of Turkey's diversification effort.
Let me just very quickly, before Cecil jumps in, ask you about the projects that are contrary to Chinese infrastructure projects cooperation. What do you mean by that?
Well, for example, the Middle Corridor, let's say, which would be mainly under the control of Turkic states. This is one example that would connect Central Asia to Europe via the Caucasus, for example.
Well, that's what I was going to ask about Central Asia, which is seems also in a period of great flux. Looking back over the last couple of decades, I mean, especially during the early years of the Erdogan rule, there was a lot of emphasis on the Turkic people of Inner Asia. You now have the Chinese clearly trying to exert influence there, but you have the Uyghur question, which, you know, the Chinese regime is not very friendly to Muslim people. And now you have the Russians in particular, who, you know, obviously tried to retain influence there, but in the wake of the recent bombing have revealed their deep sort of racial hatred of Central Asians and Muslim, made them the boogeymen for things that are wrong and taking a strong anti-immigrant or anti-Muslim stance. How do you see that ferment sorting itself out there? And I'm particularly interested in how the United States might be able to support moves to try to at least retain as much independence for the Central Asian states, regardless of their own internal political problems. It's better that they not come under the thumb of China or that the Russians not reassert their dominance over that region. What do you reckon about all that?
I think if we have realistic aspirations in Central Asia, there is a good chance that we can achieve those. And when we say we, I don't mean Turkey. Turkey and Western allies. And I think it's important that we keep our aspirations realistic. China will always be the most important economic actor in Central Asia. And when I say always, in the foreseeable future, of course. Russia will always have, in the foreseeable future, political inroads into Central Asian political systems. But Central Asian republics don't want to be politically dependent on either. And Turkey is providing them with a lifeline, actually, with the Council of Turkic States. The Council of Turkic States, which recently came under spotlight, is actually below the threshold, playing a very important role in cultural convergence between these countries. I mean, it's not a small thing that they all started using the Latin alphabet, for example. It's no small thing that Kazakhstan's president now prefers to speak in Kazakh when he's speaking to Putin, as opposed to the Russian, which he speaks like a native. But he's making the point of speaking Kazakh. These are important developments. But we also need to provide them with economic benefits. And this economic benefit would primarily come from the Middle Corridor, which would not be only a transportation corridor, but also an energy corridor, which would give these countries the choice of selling their energy to Europe and buying their goods from Europe as well. And for once, there is a great opportunity, actually, because Russia is distracted, first of all. So at least for a while, Russia cannot pay attention to what they are doing. But also, it's very interesting. Like, for the Ukraine war, Russia was pressuring Turkmenistan to send this gas east so that it could monopolize the European market. But now Russia cannot sell to the European market, so they want to actually monopolize the Chinese market. So they're telling the Turkmens, don't go east, go west. Like they were telling them to go east, now they're telling them to go west. And Turkey has very strong relationships with all of those countries, and the Council of Turkic States actually provides a one-stop shopping opportunity for Western countries wanting to do business with these countries. So I think this is the direction towards which we should be thinking. And of course, I mean, it requires its own podcast maybe, but the Azerbaijan-Armenia treaty, which is over the horizon, will actually provide us with new opportunities for realizing all of these aspirations.
We always need podcast fodder, so you'll have to come back and school us on this some more.
Yes, this is the perfect segue to look forward to another episode, hopefully soon, with Özgür joining us. But for the first time here, thank you so much for having joined us and given us not a complete tour, because we still have to go east into Central Asia, Caucasus, and Iran, but almost a 360 degrees tour. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And thanks to everyone who's listening.
from me, Yulia Zsozsa, and my friends Giselle and Dalibor, thank you for listening to the Eastern Front. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing us. To stay up to date with the Eastern Front, please give us a follow on Twitter or X at Eastern Front Pod in one word, and sign up for the newsletter included in the show notes. You can find more episodes and additional content on our website, AI.org, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you, and until next time, goodbye.